Welcome, coaches, to the Talking Split podcast again. I'm running it back this week. Rob Calder, joined by Nathan Cooper-Brown, Zoe Carr. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, cheers.
Always good to have you involved. You can follow along on the at Talking Split handle on X and Instagram, and you can send through any topics you'd like to hear discussed. If you can leave a rating and a review on Apple or Spotify for the podcast, that would be much appreciated as well. Opals, we'll talk about it. We'll go Olympics just before we get into it. Men, despite what we sort of thought might happen last week, beating Serbia when we were talking about it on the Tuesday, unfortunately did not beat Serbia, and consequently, it's on and over. Opals did, however, beat Serbia, rolled through to a bronze over the weekend. So that now makes the Opals have medalled in 6 of the last 8 Olympics and in 6 of the last 7 World Cups.
Wow.
So when you're going to talk about successful sporting teams, they've got to be up there.
Fund it. Government, fund it.
Hell of an effort.
Yeah.
Like, in all honesty, I'll be honest, like at the very start, I didn't think they were a medal team. Like, especially how they looked against Nigeria, I didn't think we would get to that point. But as it turns out, the loss to Nigeria put us in a nice little crossover where we avoided the US for an extra game and got us to the medal round. So phenomenal effort by everyone involved in that.
Yeah, it was really exciting to see, you know, the likes of Jade Melbourne, friend of the show. Jade Melbourne.
Very much friend of the show.
You know, breaking out and having a moment, you know, she's a legitimate Opal and she's a legitimate leader for that group moving forward. And you saw in the Nigeria game, you know, it was nobody's best game, but that could have gone really pear-shaped for her, being the point guard with all that pressure and the high turnover count and all that sort of stuff. The mental strength to turn that around and then eventually do particularly what she did in the Serbia game was enormous, absolutely enormous, and just speaks volumes to her. So for mine, the whole thing was incredible. We love seeing the Australians in any sport do really well, but particularly in basketball. But for mine, that was the shining light for me, was watching her just come of age almost. And
named rising star of the tournament too. Like, huge to be able to get that award. Another Victorian, Alana Smith, All-Star 5. Ezzy Magbigger's final, just wow. Like, that was everything I think everyone's been hoping from Ezzy for so long now. It's like, geez, she's probably the next one to carry a group through and be our next star. And man, did she deliver. Like, that was super impressive. So congratulations to the Opals and everyone involved in that. Fairly big moment for the show here, Coops.
You know you make me wanna shout, have my cold chance, shout, have my cold chance, shout, have my cold chance, shout, come on now.
Intro music.
Clap emoji, brother. Clap emoji.
It's Zoe heard it the first time. She's like, is that you? Hand on heart. Hand on heart. It is not me. It is an AI Elvis. It may impact negatively on our ratings and reviews moving forward. So, coaches, if you're not a fan of that, maybe don't let us know on the on socials.
Or send us something better.
Or send us something better. I'm always up for something better. So we do have a coach shout out this week. So we'll just jump into the actual segment itself. So Paige Skeels and the work she puts in at the Pakenham Warriors, and most of all, what she's doing to be a great coach. 17 years old, has been coaching domestic basketball for around 5 years now, starting at with the under-8s group. She's lucky enough to make a team at Pakenham last year, but this year focused on her coaching with the under-16-2 girls, along with her coaching domestic boys team. She's also come so far in her coaching and now teaches others. She puts in a lot of time for Big V, helping set up the sound and playing the music for the games. Just want to tell her, proud of her I am, and the time she puts into her teams because she loves the game so much. I wanted to know, it doesn't go unnoticed. Keep up the hard work. She's doing amazing things. She's also a podcast listener. And that is sent in by Jason Skills, Paige's dad, actually. So it's great to see like a father-daughter tandem coaching, because he also mentioned in the email that they do coach together, which I think is phenomenal. So any coach shout-outs you do have, please do send them through, because that would be phenomenal. We do like giving coaches the recognition they deserve, in particular to working at that grassroots level. And I know we could go to you two constantly for coaches that help in your program, but also kind of want to spread that a little wider. Because there are so many coaches out there coaching domestic basketball and really at that grassroots level that probably don't get the recognition they deserve.
Yeah, coaching six teams on a Saturday.
Yeah. I was one of those coaches once upon a time too. Like, it legitimately was. You turn up on a Saturday and you can't talk at the other end of it because you've just been yelling at people all day and trying to instruct and those types of things. It is a big part of it. So we do want to recognise the grassroots coaches in particular as we go through this. So if you do have any coach set outs, send them through and we can play that fantastic Elvis-inspired music once again. I had a couple of options. It was either Elvis or Frank Sinatra were the two that I had. The Eminem one did not sound like Eminem. Taylor Swift was eerily accurate, though. Like, AI is taking over. At some point, we won't do a podcast anymore. We'll just type a couple of prompts into GPT and we'll see how we go with it. The topic this week we're getting into, though, death, taxes, helping off the corner, and dot, dot, dot. So there are some things that it feels like are somewhat inevitable in basketball that are just going to happen regardless. And I'm sure everyone's heard of death, taxes, and whatever comes next. We've thrown in helping off the corner because we feel like it's kind of the thing that everyone does. And when we talk about helping off the corner, imagine someone driving down the right-hand lane line, a shooter in the corner, and that defender coming in to help, and just the kick-out dagger three that goes. Speaking of, the Talbot block in that Opals game. Oh, jeez.
How's the photo?
Brilliant.
Oh, unbelievable. I'd have that framed, like enlarged and framed. That's how conceited I am. But that is just one of the most amazing pictures.
There's a lot of the old hang it in the Louvre
about
that. So helping off the corner is punishable heavily.
Just quickly, sorry, just on the Opals, did you see Ezzy Megbeger's Wikipedia adjusted?
No.
It's at the bottom, right at the bottom. So talks about her achievements, including the Paris Games, and said the proud mother of the country of Belgium.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. I'm just looking at the citation, NCB.
Yeah.
But unreal. Like, I love that sort of stuff. Like, it's entertaining. So helping off the corner. Please don't help off the corner. You can stunt a little bit, you can hedge, but the second you turn your head and it's over before we've got there. So one of the hardest things to get young kids to really consider, and it comes from a good place. Hey, I'm trying to do the right thing and help my teammate that's just been blown by. It's like, yeah, but you've now just given up an open three in the highest percentage spot on the floor. Please don't do it. So we've gone together and we've gone and put a whole bunch of topics together, and I think we've got 15-ish, give or take. We'll see how we go for time as we get through them all. But, Coops, we're starting with you. Calling timeouts when it's the other team's ball.
Yeah, obviously this one is designed to help our coaches out there, and one that we see far too often. And one of the things I was thinking about when putting that one on the list was the amount of coaches that call timeouts when they've seen something through the bench and then feel like they're married to that. And then there's multiple possessions that go by. And then we've seen it. There would be, you know, the other team's ball on the baseline or the other team's ball on the sideline. And then you take that time out anyway. So you've immediately given the opposition coach a free play, a free hit. And that's obviously the last thing we want to be doing when we're talking about winning that tactical game from the sideline. So the first thing for coaches is you're not married to that timeout. If you call timeout through the bench and, you know, there's two, three, four possessions and the game has changed, cancel the timeout. Go back up to the bench, cancel it, and make sure you call the timeout when you want. Now, again, coaches are going to have different, you know, philosophies around timeout calling. Like for me personally, I much prefer to use them to break the run of the opposition. So I'm calling it, you know, as I'm walking onto the sidelines, getting in the way of a referee screaming at the bench because, you know, it's happening.
I'm making
after
sure this game stops.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, but just understanding it about, you know, having that philosophy, having a clear understanding of when you're going to call it, how it's going to impact the game, and that we never, ever want to give opposition coaches free hits like that. I remember when I was doing one of my apprentices with Tom Maher at Bulleen, which was just a fantastic experience to learn off someone with such a wealth of knowledge and what he's given to the game. And I think we were playing Hawthorn, and they called timeout when it was our ball on the baseline. And Tom just like wheeled around to me with fire in his eyes, and he goes, "Never call a timeout when it's the opposition's ball on the baseline." And I like that literally is burnt into my brain, remembering him say that. But obviously, you know, there's a real reason to why. So I implore our coaches to make that change going forward.
It's funny because Zoe's always been big on this one as well. It's been one of her things. And I remember coaching with her in a couple of NBL 1 games, and that exact same sort of thing happened. Someone's called a timeout, forgot to cancel it, and it's ended up with our ball on the baseline. We get the timeout, and I've never seen Zoe happier. Like, it's, you know, it's only when a brisket goes on that she has that same look of love in her eyes. It's kind of what it is. You've got to manage that. And as an assistant coach, if you're involved with that as well, you've got to remember as well. Because right. The coach is going through some whatever they're doing, but as the assistant coach, you can go and cancel that timeout too.
Or if you can't, because you're at a level where the assistant coaches aren't actually allowed to interact with the bench, remind your head coach, hey, cancel that timeout, because it doesn't take long. But that's your job, is to take those things off the coaches. But it's also, there's also another time when it's, even when it's your ball, not to call the timeout. Mm. And it's if you're the less talented team and you're winning, like, you don't have to use your timeouts. Don't give a more experienced or a more talented team a free hit with their coach, whether it's your ball or not. Just let the game end. Like, it's, you know, there's sometimes I think we feel like we have to use our timeouts. If you're in a position where you need to break momentum, you need to draw something up, you need to advance the ball, you need, of course, use them. But there are times where it's like, no, just let this take as much time off the clock, force the other coach to call that timeout. So then you've got yours for if you need it, if they do make a run or whatever, you know, happens within the game. But sometimes I think, it's hard. Timeout calling, especially in situations, is difficult because I think I've said it on the pod before, if it works, you're a genius, and if it doesn't, you're an idiot and what were you thinking? And as long as you've got a reason for what you're doing, but, you know, we don't have to call every one of our timeouts, just like we don't have to hold on to our timeouts. You know, if we're in the third quarter and you have to time out because the team's just blown you off the court in the first 2 minutes, you have your timeout and you go out and they do it again, blow it again. Like, it is, stop the run. Like, it's sometimes, you know, there's people I know that refuse to call timeouts that I've coached against, refuse to call timeouts in the third quarter, and I know that. So I will always press coming out of that halftime and try and get on the biggest run possible, knowing that they're not going to break it. And I won't time out in that time either. So, you know, it's those sort of things. There's so much strategy to time out calling and, you know, having a hard and fast rule for I won't or I will, I think is dangerous.
What's really interesting, and thinking back to the Olympics, so the Serbia game when the Boomers played them, Pesic down the stretch. So you think about it, timeout went, Australia called it, and straight as they've walked out, they've gone and set up, Serbia called the timeout. And I saw Pesic cop strays from everyone under the sun. What are they doing? Timeout mismanagement. Now, it did nearly cost them because they needed a timeout at the end and didn't go to it because I think one of their assistant coaches might have tried to call the timeout.
Yeah.
And they'd already used it.
And lucky they didn't get teed for it.
For sure.
Yeah.
Like, I love it from Pesic. Like, he got a look at who's inbounding, where are they setting up, who's the shooter likely to be in all of this, call the timeout, great. Now we have – and look, to be fair, the Boomers could have changed. Like, they could have gone, well, hey, we're going to go with a different play, we're going to have a different alignment, those types of things. But from their end, well, Serbia are in a position now where it's like, well, okay, are you going to stick with it or are you going to change? And it's like that whole – have you ever seen that game show Carrot in the Box? Like it's a part of
– I'm in another, my 30s.
Yeah, it's designed for people in their 30s, so – cop that, and you're not far off 40, so be very careful. It's one of those things where Coops and I will be standing opposite each other. There'll both be two boxes in front of it. One of them will have a carrot in it, and it's my job to convince you that the carrot is in my box. Right. And so you can kind of lie to them, bluff them about it, all that sort of stuff. It's a cool little trick. I'd recommend you go into it. Jimmy Carr, I think it is. But that's kind of what that timeout forced. It's like, well, okay, I've seen your alignment now, and I would assume the Boomers hierarchy is sitting there saying, have we run this set before? Do they know what this set is? Do they know what's coming? Do we have to change out of this just on the off chance that we have seen this before? Because remembering, they played each other in a pracky game before the Olympics too. Now you're maybe not running the set you want to run. You're now running one that's a little bit further down the list. I love the strategy behind it. Yeah. Like, credit to him.
Well, that was going to be my question to you, Coop. So you're at the other end, Pesic pulls that, other than both, you know, running up and going, I love you so much. would you change?
Yeah, first I'd run down and be like, that was a genius timeout. And just shake his hand, credit. Yeah. Loving this.
Yeah, got me.
Yeah. it depends on the group. Depends on the group. If I know that, like what Rob's talking about, if we have, you know, an out-of-bounds package that I'm feeling pretty confident in that we can go a little bit deeper and still have the same execution, I would consider changing it. Just, again, as a little bit of a, you know, anything you can do, I can do better. but if it was a younger group and I know it's something that was really good for us and even, you know, the opposition I know probably isn't going to change that much in terms of, you know, they wanted to see whether we advanced it or not. How much is going to change after that? They're probably still going to switch everything. This is probably going to be the personnel. Then I would stick with it.
Yep.
And it's those sort of thought processes. Like, just again, you know, I think this is a good platform to share with people my coaching journey and some things that are developing me as a coach. But obviously the Italy game still stings and will for you know, probably for the rest of my life. But, you know, we gave up the three. We're down by two. You know, we had the inbound. We didn't sweep the catch. They steal it and score. They tied the game. It was about 33 seconds or something to go. And I had a timeout left, and I know the Italian coach didn't have any timeouts, and I could have called it then. Italy had been in a zone for most of the second half, especially in the fourth quarter, which had caused us problems, and our identity was to play fast. And so for me, you know, should I have called the timeout looking back? Yeah, you know, you're looking back in hindsight, yeah, probably could have called it, probably should have called it. But at the time in my head it was, okay, yeah, it's still a tied game. There's a ton of possessions left. Our identity is to play fast. My expectation is we're still going to get the ball in and play quick. And hopefully, you know, best way to beat a zone, don't let it get set up, to be able to go down and attack and maybe get something a little bit cheap because they thought we were going to call the timeout. We went down, we had an empty possession, and I thought, so even then, if they had to come down and maybe got a basket and there was time left, that we could call the timeout and have the last play. We had the empty possession. It ended up being an out-of-bounds, so it was the opposition coach's ball. So it was Italy's ball coming back for the last possession. Again, had the timeout, wasn't going to give him a free play. So come down, we got the stop and obviously went into overtime and I lost that timeout going into it. But, you know, looking back again, you know, you can make arguments for all sorts of things, whether we should have called it or not. But at the time, and I still walk away from that moment satisfied that I had a philosophy and I had a plan, and the plan tied into our identity.
You score on that possession rather than going empty. Again, you're a genius.
Yeah, right.
Well done.
Yeah.
Way to not call that timeout. Yeah. And break your, you know, break your speed and your pace and all that sort of stuff. And that's what I mean. It's you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Yeah,
that's
but
right.
You've got to have reasons for what you're doing. And as far as I'm concerned, if you've got reasons, that's enough. Yeah. But there is never a reason to call it on the other team's
Yeah, circling back to where circling we started.
Yeah. We got there in the end.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry,
right.
That was my fault. I took us there. Sorry.
That's quite all right. Zoe, so your first one, players playing two upright after a chest blow.
Well, just no, players playing two upright in general, whether it be on any sort of catch. You know, you notice they'll get the catch, they'll square up, their legs are straight, and then they'll decide that they want to try and take their player off the bounce. So then they've got to get low and then they've got to go. And you see that the timing of that is off. So learning to stay low and wide on every catch is something I think we've got to get better at. But it's really bad after a chest blow in the girls' side. I'm not sure if it's the same in the boys, but on the girls' side, they're getting better at understanding that, hey, I can take this hit and I'll be okay. But they pop back and then they stand up. Or they wall up as soon as they've been hit. And you know what, particularly female athletes alike, jump, stop, step through. like, and it's a problem. So, yeah, I think it's one of the points of emphasis I've got at the moment, going around to the hubs and with our MPP sessions and just, you know, lowest player wins and just trying to be in that position the entire time and get comfortable playing in that position the entire time, because it is hard, it's tiring, it's all those things. But, you know, if you want to, again, modern basketball is playing fast. If you want to do that, you can't waste time being upright to then, you know, get down in that stance. You've got to be in that stance on the catch to be able to break down your defender. So, yeah, but it's particularly bad on a chest blow and allowing then sort of almost opening the gate and allowing him a straight line to the basket.
Yep, no, I like it. So one of mine, teaching structure before skill set. Like, and I'm acutely aware that we're coming into the time of year where trials are probably not too far away for most people that are jumping into the VJBL space, or new seasons might be starting in the domestic world. And most training sessions will look the same way, in that you'll roll in and it'll be 5-on-0, walk through our offense, and this is what we're going to do, and our structure is in place. It's like, yep, okay. But your players aren't getting any better. And that's kind of my bugbear, I suppose. And look, I've been guilty of this as well. I've certainly done this myself when I started coaching as well. It's like, hey, we got an hour and a half session. I reckon I can get 4 of our offenses in that hour and a half. It's like, I reckon you can't. It's not going to look good. It's one of those sorts of things. So I have a real issue with getting offense in without teaching skill set. Now, you can use your offense to teach skill set. I think there's absolutely a way, and it would probably be my preference, that the coaches go down that path of, you know, we're going to teach, you know, some shooting stuff and some shooting footwork coming off a down screen, which is actually going to be integrated into our offense because this is going to be on our second side, at whatever the case may be. That I'm cool with. But the 5-on-0 dummy walkthrough stuff with no breakdowns and teaching that goes behind it, that I think is fool's gold for me, because it'll look really nice. The timing will look great because there's no constraints. There's no defense in there that's going to make you have to sort of check your cut a little bit. Even with, and I used to hate on this for a long time, where you'd have like 7 players turn out to practice. And so you'd have 5 players doing something and 2 would just kind of sit out. I kind of got to the point now where it's like, I actually want those other 2 that would normally be sitting out defending something. Just so, like, find the read as to where that read's going to be and do it. I know you do it a little bit, Zoe, at a transition in particular, where you'll throw just a random number of kids on the court and they have to work out, well, who are they guarding, where are they guarding? I really like that. I think there's a lot to that on my end. So I would be remiss from a basketball development podcast if we're going to sit here and say offense will get you better. Yes, offense will get you better, but it's also a case of the best skilled players tend to win. Like, so teach the skill set.
Or the best skilled players tend to progress.
Yeah, well, that's
like that's probably more important from a if you're talking about the 3 of us sitting in this room and what our jobs are. And it's, you're spot on. So preseason for NBL 1, when I was coaching a million years ago, you'd never have 10 at practice in the beginning because they'd be still in WNBL and, you know, other leagues and stuff like that. So it was always just break down, we're going to play this 3v3, this action on this side. Then we're going to go to the other side and we're going to do this action. And eventually when everyone comes back together, we're going to put it together and that's going to be our offense. But it also gave us the opportunity to work what our defensive rules are. So if there's an on ball in that action that we're doing, this is how we defend on balls as our baseline. And then here are our other ones we might go to if we've got particular players or that we're coming up against or whatever. So like you said, you can still run it. And the best part about doing it that way is when you mesh it all together, you can go straight into 5v5 if you've got enough, rather than that. I don't like 5v0 really anything. Like, the only – so that drill you're talking about, we play 5v5 at one end. However, defense comes up with it is how they advance the ball, but it's 5v0 down the other end, but it's transition. So it's score in the first 8 seconds. All players must hit the tees, so they all learn lane running, even the bigs, because we don't know who's going to be big yet. Yep. So
when you say tees, you're talking half court line and
sideline. So all players must get there that are lane running. The guard must get to the seam where they're bringing the ball up the floor, kick the ball ahead and just make a layup. Like, take the ball out of bounds, sweep, you know, and come back. But then on their way back, they might have three players on D and they've got to figure out, you know, where is the D? Where's my advantage? It's a really big thing in the girls that I'm trying to break is we want to kick the ball ahead, but it doesn't always have to be down the line. It can be opposite and we're getting better, but it's not a – it stems from bulk turnovers from bringing the ball down the sideline and they can't make that pass across the court and so it gets stolen. So now it's like, oh, I kick it down the line or I just dribble the dots off it. Also trying to break the I'm bringing the ball down the floor to run offense. We are going to get a layup or put heat on the rim first or a, you know, a kick out three or something like that. If we don't get those, now we're in offense. And that's sort of what that's supposed to try and, you know, in that skill set. But you've still got your hit of your offense in that first 5v5, but you're still working a skill set and decision making and things within that. So it doesn't just a running your offense in the half, I think, is with no other, I guess, emphasis on skill set or decision making in particular, especially with younger athletes, I think is a wasted opportunity.
Yep. No, I don't mind it. Coops, back on to you again. Poor closeouts. Oh, it was an evil maniacal laugh from Coops then.
Yeah, still something we seem to have not gotten on top of, and it remains a, you know, an important teaching point and discussion point, you know, with us and basketball Australia, and obviously in terms of the pathway and our athletes being able to move up the pathway and be successful. And it needs to translate down. And 1v1 defense is king. You know, again, when we're talking about structure before skill, you know, we're so quick to create defensive schemes. If we can sit down and guard, we don't need them.
And seems stupid, doesn't it? You know, but if you can keep the ball in front of you, life's good. Why do you need to rotate?
Right, exactly. Yeah. You know, and, you know, providing as many opportunities to work the closeout in everything that you're doing. You could start a shooting drill or segment with a closeout. You could close out a player and then sprint into a shot. You could start a defensive drill easily, you know, with two or three rehearsed closeouts or a live closeout. You know, it's one of the hardest things to do as an individual in terms of being able to close out, contain, contest. But they need the reps. They need the feedback. It's just got to be something that needs to be prioritized more. And it's something just as simple as nose on high shoulder. You know, there's plenty of ways that coaches may redefine that, you know, high leg above high leg, close out the high side, whatever it may be. But just getting that, you know, for lack of a better term, muscle memory to start being, you know, just a much more efficient, much more productive 1v1 defender, starting with the closeout in taking away the rhythm three, taking away a straight line drive, especially through the middle. Now, you, of course, you may be a forced middle defense, but, you know, that's pretty
or
rare.
Or it might be a scout.
Or a scout, yeah.
Send, left, and that means right. Sending them to the middle.
Right. But I think just the more we're going to invest in this, the more it's going to translate just throughout our community in terms of, you know, the success that we want to have on the floor, both with teams and individuals.
Yeah, I must admit, I've stopped using the Chris Paul starts. So Chris Paul starts would be defense sits in front, offense behind with the ball on their back and start. I've started to go away from that a little bit now. I'll still use it occasionally, but I've stopped purely because I want the closeout first. And I'm a little bit similar with the whole get your foot outside the three-point line.
Oh, tag outs, no.
Yeah, that drives me a little crazy. Yeah. It's like, well, now we're reinforcing bad closeouts.
Yeah.
Like we've got a little bit of it. There is something to be said for knowing when you've made a good closeout too. Like you have that feeling of, geez, I've got there really quick. I've had the little choppy steps. You can argue whether you want those or not on every person and hand above the ball. And it's like, geez, that felt good. And I've gone down the path now of saying, well, we have to start everything with a closeout just to reinforce that. And it'll be one of the first things I'll ask players, like, how did that closeout feel? Like, what was it out of 10? And I was like, oh, 2. Okay, what would you fix? Like those types of things. Because I think it's valuable for our players to understand what does a good closeout feel like as well. It's not just a case of, oh, well, I contested it, so we're good. It's like, yeah, you contested it, but you would have been scored on by 9 out of 10 players. Like, it's that kind of thing.
Do you think that our closeout across the board has suffered? I'm not saying it is or it isn't, just throwing it out. since we've moved to neutral stance on the closeout, because some could argue that when we were like sort of strictly force baseline, there was at least
a direction.
Yeah. They're more likely to then to go that way, so you can anticipate that a little bit quicker and all that sort of stuff. Has the neutral stance where we're not just forcing straight. Either way, we're straight line
or butt to basket.
Has that contributed? I don't know. I'm just throwing it out as a – because we do need to try and find the answer. Yeah.
My antagonistic side would say yes, just because I feel like I like conflict and types of things. But I kind of feel like it might, because you are in that position defensively where how much are you controlling what the offense does?
Yeah, you're not really being proactive.
No, you're not. So I'd probably – and I've always been a force baseline coach anyway, so it's a little bit different, I guess. But I would feel more comfortable knowing that I know where the ball's going as the closeout person, but my other four teammates know where it's going, rather than the offense dictating to me, you know, if I've thrown out a lead foot or something like that, that they can attack that. Will my other four teammates know that that's being attacked as well? So I feel a little more comfortable with it going baseline. But I also see the need for the ability to have neutral closeouts too. Like if you're closing out someone in a corner, like you may need to keep them off that baseline drive, because obviously that will probably create a split kick extra type situation. So I think yes, but I say that without confidence. Yeah. What about you, Coop?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question, and definitely the kind of discussions we need to keep having. I would say no, but I'm thinking one from the lens of teach the hardest thing first. Which has kind of become a little bit of a theme of ours at BV, which has been helpful in terms of trying to progress the athletes, especially around decisions. The other one for me too, I think if you get a lead leg closeout wrong, it's going to hurt you more than a non-lead leg closeout.
Yeah, fair point.
But I think a caveat is, you know, you look around the world and there's more run off the line closeouts.
Yeah.
There's more, again, decision, potentially scout based or even just scheme based of, you know, we're not giving up a three. So we're happy to be more of a run off the line closeout team, and then we'll rotate from behind or whatever it may be to play the way that we want to play. So I think there's room to have further discussion there around how that could potentially translate to a more of a shading or forcing, you know, are we going to like run off the line with a baseline shaded closeout or vice versa or whatever it may be. So, yeah, I think we just have to keep talking about it. We have to keep teaching it. You know, we need to show it on film. It just has to be more of a priority than it is right now.
Yeah.
Yep. No, fair point. All right, Zoe, we're on to you next. Playing off one foot. I don't know, Coops, you put some words together last week that we shared on X, and Coach NCB, if you want to go and have a little bit of a read about playing off 2 feet, in particular with finishing, but you've thrown this one in here, Zoe.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of jumping to make to find passes. I have no issue if you're jumping to make a pass. You know where it's going and you need to elevate above the defense to make that pass.
Yep.
But if you leave your feet and you don't know where it's going, that's a problem for me, and it often happens off one foot. So, yeah, a big theme of ours at the moment is playing off 2 feet and particularly off a pivot, because we've talked so much about passing and turnovers being a problem, and passing is not just about the hands, it's about the feet as well. Pass with your feet, catch with your feet. So, yeah, I think doing a better job of getting feet in the paint. If you don't know the decision, come to your 2 foot stop. It'll give you an extra second. But again, and especially in the women's game or the girls game, that gives you the chance to up fake, step through once or maybe even twice, like, you know, and have that action or find the open player or whatever comes of it. But I think, particularly off on-ball screens. We come off an on-ball screen, we take one dribble, one sort of step and try and throw it with no angle, no vision through the elbow to see the tagger coming, because often it's the I'm looking as if I'm looking in the corner, the opposite corner.
I was trying to work out what you were doing.
Yeah.
Again, audio medium.
Yeah. You're the roller, Rob, and the corner's over there. Yeah.
No. Well, don't throw it to me as the roller. I can promise you that, and I will be popping.
But the weak side corner is open, but we don't see that because we've taken our one step and now it's got to go. So, yeah, those sort of things. Just playing off that 2 feet, again, that plays into playing low and not being upright and all those sort of things. And we're seeing, again, it's been a massive emphasis for us and we're seeing the benefits of that now. It's not where it needs to be, but it's getting there.
Yeah, it's funny too how a player coming to, say, a jump stop in the paint and playing off 2 feet usually creates a lot of anxiety for the defense too, because now the five defenders or the four that aren't guarding the ball are like, oh, hang on, something's happened. Where's my player? Now they start looking around with like, where is my player? Do I have to go and get eyes on the ball instead? That does create back cut opportunities. Like I find, and this might just be the eye test, I've got no data to back this up whatsoever, as you know, 84% of all good statistics don't. But it is one of those things where I feel like coming off a jump stop actually creates more back cut opportunities than playing off 1 foot. I don't know if it's a visual thing or not, but I tend to see it more often. And that, you know, you can jump to make it but not to find it, I think is really valuable in that sort of world too. And it's the same in the backcourt. How many times do you see someone getting pressured in the backcourt, they pick up their dribble and they're on 1 foot like a flamingo? It's like, no, like play off two, pivot, throw it out of court if you have to.
Throw it off their leg, yeah, whatever you
need
to do.
Don't try and make it with 1 foot in the air as you're off balance and falling away as the defense has climbed into it. So I think for mine, the playoff 2 feet makes a lot more sense. And a couple of people did reach out after last week's podcast and sort of say, oh, you know, you guys used to say, you know, finish off one because it's quicker. Yeah, okay, basketball evolves. It changes continually. No problem with it. I'm still not suggesting you can't play off 1 foot. I'm saying my preference at the moment with how basketball is being played is to play off two.
Well, and particularly if you haven't made your decision yet.
Yep.
If you haven't made, like if you know you're getting on the rim and 1 foot's going to work, well, yeah, like it is quicker. Get it on the backboard as quick as you can, especially in the men's game with got like goaltend rules and all that sort of stuff that comes into play. Absolutely. But if you haven't made your decision, it's a 2 foot stop. Like a 2 foot stop and a pivot.
Yeah, you're both spot on. And Rob, I'm with you on the back cutting stuff, because what do players, you know, naturally do when you drive? They turn and follow and collapse and lose sight of their player. So now when you're on that first pivot and they're in that kind of panic station and turning and sprinting back out to where they think their man is, that is absolutely the time for that, you know, for that secondary back cut. And I think, you know, we can be better at that as a community of creating more high percentage plays. And then not to step on one of my ones from later, but you know, just double clicking on what Zoe's talking about is the scanning piece. And if you watch the players, especially when they're doing things like, you know, trying to make a pass or a finish off 1 foot, they're looking at their teammate. So they're going into their gather, they're looking at the teammate, they've taken no snapshot of the defense. They are completely unaware of what the defense is doing. They take off on 1 foot. They're eyeballing their teammate, so they're immediately selling where the ball is going, giving away. And they throw it. Excuse me. And there's the defense picking it off. And you watch the best players in the world, like Luka Doncic is one of the best at it. Like eyes are constantly through the defense. Like everything is scanning. You should know where your teammates are. You've either got a patterned offense, which I would say on Friday night, 99.99% of you do. So you should know where they are in terms of that. And then the secondary movement, you should have some pretty good chemistry with your teammates anyway. So there's no real reason for you to be eyeballing teammates. Your eyes should only be through the defense. What's my primary defender doing? What's a secondary defender doing? What's a tertiary defender doing? And they are the ones that make the decision for you. And coaches need to coach the eyes. Get more time spent on the baseline as an offensive coach. We always go and walk down on the baseline when we're doing shell drill, whatever it may be. But get down there as a coach when you're coaching offense and coach the athlete's eyes. Where were they looking? What were they looking at when they made those decisions?
Yep. I think that's also really important with the comment with, you know, with your offense. You should know where everybody is and all that sort of stuff. And it goes back to what we spoke about before. So if you're teaching your offense in a small-sided game, for example, always have it, and it's something we always have, basketball overrides.
Right.
Right? So if defense starts to cheat or they start to try and take something away because they know the drill is this, and they overplay, back cut. You know, drive, take that, and if you get, even if you get that back cut or you get that layup because defense has cheated, you get the ball back. Like, so just so it keeps defense honest. I like defense, by the way, starting to cheat things and, sure, you know, try, yeah, and hack the drill a little bit. I like that. But it's giving the permission, I guess, to I don't want to see you run a drill. I want to see you play basketball. And that sort of stuff then, that scanning stuff becomes really important because I'm not just looking here because you told me to pass it here. I'm looking through, again, through the elbows or wherever it is, depending on where you are on the floor. I'm looking here and I'm playing the game. And if I can go into that on-ball screen, for example, because that's what we're working on at the moment, then I'll do that. But if you take that away, I'm going on to what's next and create basketballers rather than just offensive robots.
Yeah, we will, yep, dial into your next one, Coops, which is the lack of scanning on offense. Mm. So for those of you that haven't listened to the Talking Split back catalogue, one, do it. Two, rating and review. Always five
good
stars.
Good ones only.
Yeah, good ones only. But we have discussed scanning a little bit. In particular, it's more about when you don't have the ball than when you do have the ball. That the ability to know, look, where would my extra pass be? What is the defense doing? But part of that, Coops, is obviously, as you said, read where the defense is. You don't need to look at your players. You just need to be aware of where they are. So things like receiver principles. Coming out of 16 Nationals, I was really impressed, and it cuts me a little bit to have to say this, was really impressed with Queensland's use of their bigs in particular in the receiver spots. Mm. Like, I thought they, yeah, did a phenomenal job of dribble penetration, bigs wheeling up, wheeling under. Great work by them to be able to get that drill to a point where it was second nature. There were times they threw passes and it's like, that player hasn't even arrived yet, but they know they will be. Mm. So they had that second nature of, well, I know what's going on here. I know how the D is going to play me, because they were reading the D. They did a great job, I thought, on just having some awareness. And I think that teaching of receiver principles in particular for our junior players, where, like, if you drive at this angle with this form of intensity, where is the help likely to come from and where do I need to position my players so that I can find them with the right passing angle to get it done. So that's kind of the scanning piece, I suppose. And obviously, Coops, you know, as you're well and truly aware, it came from that football mentality that's now starting to transition into basketball.
Yeah, yeah. There's been some really good research done, obviously, coming through football, through soccer. I mean, I recommend coaches just jumping on YouTube. There's some really good, short, punchy videos that relates to scanning and how it's used in football. You know, again, we've spoken about Messi, you know, and the amount of, I think it's like 630 times a game or something he scans. But the idea is it's this quick head turn. Okay, I'm in the middle of the pitch. You know, I'm left-footed. I like to turn and get on my left. So I'm going to, you know, if my back's to goal, I'm quickly going to check over my right shoulder. Where's that centre half? Okay, they're right on me. Okay, I'm probably, when this pass gets me, I'm probably going to have to turn right. You know, or, oh, they're back. Okay, I'm going to go there. Oh, but the fullback's also closing me down. So if I turn there, I'm going to turn into two players. It's that ability to gather the data, like you're saying, Rob. Gather the data prior to the catch. Gather the data prior to the decision. It's only going to make you a better decision maker if you are operating from a place of knowledge that you already know what's in front of you, what you're about to see. And again, I watch a lot of, you know, VJBL athletes, or, you know, a lot of athletes that come into our pathway, and it's not second nature. It's not being taught. You even look at the body position. We talk a lot about this in our program. Zoe and I have been talking about this for 6 years, you know, around how the players are setting up on the perimeter. And you watch them and it's hips and shoulders and eyes to the ball. So they're actively, body is in this, that, like, looking at the ball and I'm, you know, receiving the pass from the ball, rather than hips and eyes and shoulders through the game. You know, I know where the ball is. Let's say it's over to my right. I can use my peripheral vision. I know, you know, if that pass or when that pass is coming to me. I want to be prepared to stampede the catch or catch and shoot or see the defense. So these little details are really important to helping our athletes, you know, become better decision makers, become better athletes, and it's our responsibility to coach that.
And part of it too, I think, is scanning in basketball is actually a little bit easier unless you play in the high post. Like, because we don't tend to play in the middle of the floor a lot in that sort of space. Right. We tend to play sort of seams to sidelines in most cases. If you're a high post flash, well, yeah, okay, middle of the foul line or the nail, you might get that. If you're flashing in the press, yes, you might get that, where you need that 360 vision of what's going on. Realistically, it's for most of our players, it's really just what's in front of you. Mm-hmm. And the scanning actually directly impacts the timing of when to get open and how to get open. And that's one thing I've noticed a lot with our junior players of late is not necessarily doing the work to get open, or the timing is slightly out. They'll do all this work to get open, but the ball's not ready to be passed yet. So they have to go and do it again. So naturally, they don't do it quite as well the second time through, and that leads to deflections and those types of things that come with it. So the ability to know where the ball is, where will the ball be going, and what does that do for me and my body position, all links in together. And it should be a little bit easier in basketball because, again, you are normally forward-facing as to where you have to scan. You don't often have to know what's going on behind you unless you're in like a Princeton-type offense where you may need to be slightly more aware of back cuts and those types of things. But generally speaking, especially on the offensive end, you should have a fairly good understanding of that. Defensively is a different world altogether because that will be 360 as to where you need to potentially look on that one. So it is a really fascinating topic. I would really recommend coaches having a little bit of a muck around with that. I saw something not too long ago, actually, where they were doing it with balloons, and it was almost like, I think they'd split it up into two teams and both teams had different colored balloons, and you could hit your balloon, but then you had to go and try and get someone else's balloon from your team and keep it in the air. And it was kind of working on, well, okay, where are my teammates? Where is the balloon at this point in time? Where do I have to get to? Okay, I can deal with mine here, but then where do I have to get to next? And it was all around just that perception, but also avoiding the other team at the same time. It's like, well, I need to get over there, but there's two people in my way to get there. How can I avoid that and run around it? So kind of a cool little concept of just trying to find different ways to sort of teach something, but a real easy warm-up drill too. Like fun, engaging straight away. The amount of people that can't tie up a balloon is maybe a little bit troubling, but, you know, try and find different ways to do it. Maybe like use bouncy balls or something like that. But it's those types of things which I think can really help our players, just awareness around them as what's going on in that sort of space. My next one, and this is a little bit tongue-in-cheek, my worst shooter is always being on the extra pass. Like, the amount of times that happens
drives me.
It's great deep. It's scout dependent, as it turns out. But there were a couple of times, in particular in the Olympics, where you'd see the kick out pass and the extra get made, and it's like, oh, you've just gone from like a 42% 3-point shooter to a 22% 3-point shooter on that extra pass. Probably prefer the 42% contested over the 22% uncontested at times. I don't know how it happens. It just seems to happen all the time. Maybe it's a case of I need to get my weaker shooters to cut a little more often so that it's almost like a bit of a vacuum. They'll suck a couple of extra defenders with them on that way through, which will lead something else to get open. It's a tough one. There's no real easy way out of this, unfortunately, because good basketball decisions are good basketball decisions, but sometimes a good basketball decision isn't to give it to the open person. Like, there's the I don't know if you've seen the clip of Steph Curry in the gold medal game taking a three, which was utterly ridiculous, and his entire gold medal game was utterly ridiculous in the first place, where he's taking a contested shot with two people on him with hands up, and Kevin Durant and LeBron James are on the other side with their hands up like, we're open. And I think the caption is something along the lines of, this is the only time where the shot is a better option than passing the ball to the other side of the floor. A contested Curry three is still a high percentage shot than anything over the other side of the floor. We're good. But it's legitimate. Like, there are times where there are just kids you don't want to shoot the ball, and they are the ones that get open. And, you know, you kind of, hey, there might be a reason you're always getting open on this. You got to try and reinforce, well, okay, you got to go and put some time in, because if you are getting this open, you have to go and be accountable to this shot. Otherwise, you just become another defender.
Well, and that was what I was going to say, like, from a junior perspective, don't avoid that. Help that athlete get better at sticking that shot rather than, you know, oh, well, I know there was a coach recently that had rules that only certain players could shoot threes and other players had to be drivers. That's hampering development. So grab that player and say, show them film of, look how open you're getting and how often. Let's learn to capitalize on this. So let's, you know, let's take 53s in the corner before practice, or make 53s in the corner before practice, or help with the mechanics, or, you know, whatever the problem is for those shots. And then as soon as they shoot one and nail it, like, lose it on the sideline, like be so excited for them because that'll obviously help them continue to do that work and take that shot. But obviously as you get older and you start to get into more pro basketball, obviously things are a bit different there and you might want to work on it, but there might be rules of you don't get to take that shot until you've reached a certain level in practice or something like that. But, you know, if we have more of that development mindset of, okay, I'm going to help this kid get better at that, maybe once we get to pro levels, those rules wouldn't have to be in because we'd have more rounded players.
Yeah, that's a good one. You hear college coaches talk about that quite a bit around, you know, earning your shooting license or different things like that. And again, it's a different environment. It's a daily environment. Mm. So there's a little bit more of a luxury of doing that. Probably the only thing to add from me is, and again, it's probably for more of our advanced coaches and athletes, from a tactical perspective, and you look at like the NBA and Steph Curry's a good example of this, is if that extra pass does come to, let's say, a non-shooter, then that player will just go and take the ball into the next two-man game. So it's a really quick catch and go, creating a 2v1 in what usually ends up being like a really quick like pitch and follow screen or handoff. So if that next player is a shooter, it's like, okay, cool, we've still got him in dominoes. I'm just going to go get it to that next guy, set a great screen for them and keep trying to hold that advantage from the extra pass into a 2v1. But again, that can be, yeah, that's a little bit advanced.
Well, way too advanced what I'm about to say for juniors. But if we can start to get little bits of this, even crumbs of it, amazing. But if we can be scanning the floor and seeing what's about to happen, penetration's about to happen, chances are we're about to get into a split kick extra, back screen the shooter into the corner, you become the kick catch and they become the extra. You know, those sort of things can be huge. Difficult, not denying that, but, you know, if... You know, we can start and read personnel, you know, particularly sort of under 18s, as they're about to step into that senior landscape. You know, that could be something that could be really beneficial to them and make them more playable.
Coops, you hit on a term there that we haven't used a huge amount, dominoes. Do you want to just take us through that, just for anyone unaware?
Yeah, it's just a game.
Not the pizza?
Definitely not the pizza. If they want to sponsor the podcast, here for it.
Hey, like, no,
absolutely, yeah. I'll break my fast for some delicious dominoes at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday morning. Dominoes just another way of framing split kick extra in terms of, you know, creating an advantage, keeping an advantage, and exploiting an advantage. And that's kind of how we frame it here in our programs. But, you know, split, you know, can I split a line of the defense? So can I beat my primary defender? Which is going to cause a reaction. So the rotation, so you get a player leaving their man. So beaten my player, now I've engaged a second defender, that's my kick. And then when the subsequent, you know, rotation goes and we've got our extra. And then if you think about all those players starting to rotate and chase their tail, it's that imagery of the dominoes, you know, pushing each other over and falling. And the idea is that we run offense to create dominoes. We run offense to create split kick extra. And so that play after the play, that dominoes, is really what we're trying to get to, and we want to be great in that because that's where we're going to get our best shots. So obviously that's something we want to talk about with athletes and teach up as much as possible.
Yep, excellent. I've just seen how many we've still got left and how long the pod's been going for. Part two next week. You both on notice. We'll knock out the rest of them. Zoe, we'll go with one of yours. Just as we're starting to wind up, guards dribbling to the sideline.
Yes. Well, I've mentioned that already, and it starts early. It starts in like under eights, and we've spoken about this on the pod before. Under eights basketball, you know, drive down more often than not the right-hand side and all 10 are running down that right-hand side. Miss the layup, the other team rebounds, they go down their right-hand side and it's just a track meet of 10 players for 40 minutes or however long they play. It's very cute. But our point guards need to play in the seams. So they not the middle of the floor, not on the split line. in the seams. And for those that may not know, the seams are if you had the old elbow and the new elbow and you drew lines all the way down the floor on both sides, they're the seams. So try and play in those. Because as I mentioned before, to advance the ball, we want to kick ahead ideally if we can to try and put heat on the rim in transition early. But down the line may not be open and opposite may be open. And so going opposite is not a problem from the seam. It's a big problem from the sideline, particularly in girls, particularly in young girls, because they don't have the strength yet to make that pass. You know, you could see, you know, our Opals probably can make that pass, but they've been in the gym room for years. Our younger girls don't have that strength yet. Or there might be a couple, but it's not consistent across the board. So playing in those seams and fighting for those seams and staying off sidelines. And the answer because it's a rule in our program, and I had an athlete say, but it's open down the sideline. Which I love that, because I always talk about, again, basketball overrides, take what the defense gives you. But now we've got to talk about why that's open. So what are our defensive transition rules? Pin to sideline. Why is that? Oh, so we can lock off down the line and it's harder to make that pass. So have I answered your question? And she's like, I think I answered my own question. And I was like, well done. But I like that she had that thought of, but hang on, that's open. You tell me to go where is open. But now that's that secondary thought of why is that open? That's open for a reason, because that's where they want you to go. So we've got to fight for that and for all those reasons. Once that down the line pass is locked off, it's really hard to enter your offense without dribbling the dots off the ball. If you've got a crazy quick, you know, Patty Mills in his prime quick point guard, you could probably go wherever you want because you're going to get by. Yeah, but majority aren't so. So, yeah, fighting and getting that in as early as possible will be massive for point guards, because you'll see less turnovers, which means more confidence handling the ball, obviously more better advancement of the ball, and helps teach spacing in running as well, lane running as well, because if I'm in the seam with the ball and you're in the same seam, I can't get you the ball. So it's, if you want it, you have to get wide. Or if you're the big as you get older and you know who's big and who's not, you have to get in the other seam. So I've got that angle to make that pass. So it really helps with your overall transition lane running as well, and learning that from an early stage.
Yep. And for our rep coaches, you know, in terms of responsibility of getting the athletes to where they want to go, just building further context around, you know, international basketball and state level basketball, when you've got big, aggressive, strong guards. And we saw it in the Nigeria game with the Opals. We saw it at the Olympics. We saw it at both the under 17 worlds. As soon as you get close to that sideline, you're getting bumped out of bounds. It's no call. And all of a sudden, you know, we're in a little bit of trouble. So, like, this thing, the earlier this thing starts, the better it is all the way down the line, you know, all the way to green and gold. So, yeah, it's definitely one we've got to get on top of.
Yeah.
And it's a few components, because it's strength matters. Like, you have to be physically strong to be able to go and take that level of contact. But you have to have a change of pace as well, because we see very one-tempo guards that might be very quick, as you sort of mentioned, Zoe, but don't have that ability to sort of back it off or know when to use that speed. The best guards, I don't feel like, go at 100% all the time.
No.
They sort of idle along at around about 80 to 85. They have another gear they can go to when they need to get there. So it might be a case of, look, you can get towards the sideline because you're quick enough, you can get away with it. But the ability to back that off and go a little bit slower and play with a little bit more poise is vital as well for our youth athletes.
Yeah, and I've been the athletes that have been coming to the Saturday sessions, they probably dream about hearing this voice of, fight for the seam. It's literally all I say for the whole session.
Because we send it to all their phones and it just plays while they sleep.
Clockwork Orange.
Yeah. But we had the All Vic MPP session on Sunday, and one of the girls who's been coming to the Saturday sessions, who is under 14s, so she's very young, but outlets to her, She goes to the seam. One of the under 18s girls comes to defend her, bodies on her, and she steps into her and just like, no, I'm taking this seam. Like, this is mine. And I it's so gross, but like, I was so excited. I genuinely nearly wet my pants. Like, it was so exciting. And
what an incentive for kids too. Incontinence. Yeah. Try and send Zoe there if you can. Yeah.
But it was just, and all she would have heard was, yes, from the sideline. I hope we got it on film so I can put it up. But it was a really cool moment. But then we also saw how quickly defense backed off when they were in that seam as opposed to on the sideline. Because when you force someone to the sideline as a defender, you've won. And so now I'm going to be a pest. I'm going to climb in because I've got the advantage of the sideline defender on my side. And now I've got that little bit of extra energy and I've got, you know, because I'm winning this battle. But when she basically said, nah, I'm not giving up this seam, defense backed off and she was able to advance the ball easily. So it was a really cool moment. But it's, again, that's taken a lot of work and it's got to be consistent. Like it's, I know I joke about constantly yelling out fight for the seam, genuinely constantly yelling out fight for the seam. It's got to be, so it builds that habit.
Look at a guy like Nick Kalathis, you know, point guard for Greece. Was he like 39-ish? Yeah, comfortably. Like
Sergio Lul for Spain as well. Like all those guys. There was someone from Serbia, Mikic.
Yeah.
From Serbia.
Yeah. Right,
like,
exactly.
Phenomenal.
Like shifty ball handling, change of pace, change of direction like you're talking about, Rob. Physicality, like you're talking about, like their hand. If you watch their offhand, constantly like whacking the defender's arm away or kind of grabbing the leg to get a step, like just so much smart basketball in there to fight for the seam. And it just shows that you don't have to be the best athlete because these guys definitely aren't, you know, to be able to execute that. So it's there for everybody.
Excellent. Hey, thank you both for jumping in. We've gone over an hour and we've still got a fairly sizable list. So as I said, I was joking, but I'm not joking. Back in next Tuesday for both of you. Sure. And we're going to go for part two. Coaches, thanks very much for listening. Once again, good luck with your games and your training sessions during the week. Just a reminder, any coach shout-outs, please do send them through. Book Club will be back next week as well. I'm on deck for that one. So we'll jump back into that one as well. Coaches, good luck with it all. And thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.